Hello and welcome to the Day Zero update for July 19th, 2015. I'm Filippo DeNolfo.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
I'm Lee Lamb.
And I'm Teresa Sammons.
And Pat, you got a kind of a note in the show notes here about this show's kind of turning into a little bit of a different beast than it was originally intended to be. We were planning to basically spend the entire show talking about Satoru Iwata, but
last weekend is cursed.
Issues. Yeah, had issues. Let's just put it that way.
So, had a computer hard shutdown while recording. The first part of the show was saved, and then when we resumed, it was not picking up my voice. So it eventually reduced itself to Brandon talking to no one in particular and still holding down a coherent conversation, but
awesome, yeah. Actually,
that's mostly just because I really love to hear myself talk. Yeah. I can pretty much have a conversation with with myself in an empty room, so
that's why you're not on Facebook.
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm just kidding.
Also, I'm Batman.
Yeah. So that's what happened to Let's Weekend. I mean, I think that computer shutdown was probably related to the stuff you were saying and Alex Jones not liking it. So, you know, that probably happened. So, yeah.
Hopefully, but for those of you who are listening to us and also are subscribed to Let's Weekend, we do promise we will eventually get these corrected and have an actual show put out, and we promise it'll be worth it. So,
yeah. You know, these are the
just stick with us.
That shows must go through, and I am not I do not have Phil's talent as a producer, apparently. So, and apparently, my computer is also a little too dusty for its own good, and I got to get on that.
Yeah, I was thinking that's probably what was going on.
That's probably the issue. Utah is a dust climate, and it only takes a few months to get pretty bad.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So,
and just for the record, when we say that Pat's computer shut down, we mean literally without any warning.
Yeah, it was just – I was sitting here talking and then off. Like, it was like a power outage. I had to stop and make sure it wasn't a power outage at first.
Yeah. Just one of those. Gone.
Yep.
Yep.
So that's what happened with Let's Weekend. Hopefully we'll get that sorted out over the next few days.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I wanted to kick us off with what we're playing. And this week's been kind of interesting for me as I've been playing that new Sega/Game Freak collaboration, Tembo the Badass Elephant.
And interesting is a word with many, many different kinds of connotations. So.
Yeah, I'm going to put very giant quotes on that. Editorially, I can't really say anything about the game until tomorrow. So the review's written. Will be posted 10:05 a.m. Eastern. So stay tuned for that.
At most, we will say the game is interesting.
Yes, it is very interesting.
And by interesting, we mean all the implications of that word.
Yep.
Just
and
every one
at the same
of them.
Time, none of the ones or few of the ones that I speak to when I refer to Lost Dimension as interesting, which I also really can't say that much about.
Yeah. So I'm guessing that's one of the things you've still been playing, Pat.
Yep. That's on my list. I still have to wrap up the main quest, but I'm getting there. I've admittedly been sidetracked by more than a couple things. Not the least of which has been Final Fantasy XIV. I finally got to the Heavensward content, and I am not at all disappointed by Ishgard. This is basically a little slice of Skyrim in Eorzea, and you get further along in the main story, and you eventually end up in a place called Dravania, which is sort of the dragon country. And that,
because every RPG has to have one.
Aesthetically, it reminds me quite a bit of some places that I saw in the original Guild Wars. So that's the first thing that came to my mind. But yeah, I'm thoroughly enjoying Heavensward, and I And I absolutely can talk about that. So,
yeah,
I'm currently doing the 50 to 60 content, and yeah, it's really well paced. I've only had to stop and level grind once, and you know, I have no idea how they're going to settle this story down to the point that you get back to the sense of of being able to roam freely, because obviously in MMORPG you can roam freely anytime you want, but the tension that the story lays on you really it makes you nervous about being in certain places that you might have, you know, been to 1,000 times going into the expansion. And so yeah, I'm interested in seeing where 3.0 takes us. I'm pretty sure I haven't seen all of the areas yet. And then on top of that, this being Evo weekend, I've been sort of toying with the idea of getting back into fighting games. This has been a really good Evo so far. And mm-hmm. when Evo's at its best, it can really remind you of what's great about the genre. Especially if you need a reminder of what's really great about the fighting genre. And so, one game I've been playing in particular, and this was, I got this before Evo started, so it's just kind of a good correlation. But, Yatagarasu, it's a $15 I say indie, but I have it with the quotes in the air, fighting game. It's $15 on Steam. It's made by people who were involved in Street Fighter III Third Strike, King of Fighters during the Neo Geo days, and it really shows when you're watching it, when you're playing it. It really is a proper old-school 2D fighter that that has all the depth that it needs and all the competitive balance that it needs while still not subjecting itself to what you might call post Street Fighter IV development philosophy. So, and that in and of itself, I would say, makes the game extremely strong. And I'm thoroughly enjoying it. The whole thing with Evo happening right now and everything has made me want to get back into a full slate of fighters. But you know, in addition to Yatagarasu, I'm probably going to end up playing Ultra Street Fighter 4 again, at least for a little while. Mm-hmm. At least till Street Fighter 5 comes out. Also, I need to get on that Mortal Kombat 10. I need to get on, lots of things, really.
DOA 5, Last Round.
DOA 5. Killer Instinct I'm going to be playing again, of course. And once again, Yatagarasu, because that's something I really want to, you know, I want to do my part to help this game succeed. And fighting games, the way to do that is to sit down and play it. And yeah, Yatagarasu is definitely compelling enough. Brandon?
My primary gaming right now has been focused on Batman Arkham Knight. For real, this time. I mentioned last time, I got it last Saturday, and, you know, and I was going to, that night, went to my room, put it in my Xbox One. I was like, oh, man, I can't wait to play the new Batman. And then I remember, oh, right, this is Xbox One. I have to install this shit first. So I had to wait until the following the next day to actually play it. But I am actually playing it now, for real. And I am indeed thoroughly enjoying it. I will say I don't understand what some people's problem with the whole Batmobile thing is, because I actually quite enjoyed it.
How far are you into it?
Oh, I'm still like the first. Let me put it this way. The Arkham Knight still has Barbara. So.
Okay.
But yeah, it turns into a freaking tank. I mean, a tank that, granted, also fires rubber bullets, which, you know, now that I think about that, just because it's rubber bullets doesn't mean they're not lethal. Especially when they're being fired out of a high-caliber, military-grade automatic machine gun.
Yeah, they could go right in between, well, right into somebody's eye, and that's the end of that little digital guy. You're going to poke an eye out with that thing. Sorry.
Speaking of which, if as you're in the Batmobile, there are still, like, other dudes roaming the street, and if you run into them, instead of just running over them like, you know, like you would in GTA, the Batmobile has this, like, taser or something that's built into it, and every time you hit someone, it hits them with electric shock, and they go flying, like, 5 feet in the opposite direction. It's actually pretty funny.
I just want to add to that. If you...
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, if you think the Batmobile tank is cool, you should check out what's going on in the comics right now.
Yeah, they basically have moved the entire Batcave into the Batmobile at this point.
Well, it's a semi-truck, and the Batmobile is the Batcave.
Yep, pretty much.
So here's the thing. I would say probably amongst our podcast group, I am probably the most, like, hardcore Batman fan.
Yes.
Honestly, like, the only step that I haven't taken is getting a Batman tattoo. I love that character. I love that character since I was a kid. And the thing is that I always see, like, kind of like this I don't know. I see this thing crop up, like when you're talking about, like, the rubber bullets and everything else like that. Like, unfortunately, to make, like, the thing that people don't really understand is Batman has no issue with maiming people.
Yeah.
Like, and I've read in the forums and stuff like that, like, oh, it's so lame. Like, you know, I can't kill these guys. Like, okay, well, first of all, if you played a game to kill people, it shouldn't be one with Batman. And I understand, like, what you guys are saying, like, yeah, if it hits somebody in the eye. But the thing is, Batman doesn't have any issue giving anybody brain damage either.
That's true.
Like, he
quite a few times in the game, he'll just straight up snap a dude's arm.
Yeah.
So
the trope is called good is not nice.
Yeah, like, he is not a nice person.
It's just the one thing he does is he does not use guns,
right,
or really lethal force in general.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the sort of – there's always some sort of issue that can be taken, like, with the idea, like, oh, Batman doesn't use guns. But then his, you know, like, in Arkham Knight, like, oh, well, the Batmobile has a 60-millimeter gun. Okay. So, you know, I can understand, like, why people get upset about that, but it is also just a video game, and frankly, it's the best superhero game. Arkham Knight, unequivocally, by the way, is probably the best superhero game ever made. However, Brandon, like, what you were talking about with the tank battles, the problem with the tank battles, and I said this because I 100%ed the game. The problem with the tank battles is that there are too many of them. Like, I understand, like, Rocksteady obviously put the Batmobile in the game because if they had just released it without the game, they probably would have been accused of doing something stale. You know, people would have been like, we've already played this. Because, matter of fact, I don't know if it happened to you, but for the first, I'd say for the first hour or so, the game felt so similar to Arkham City that it was almost a turnoff for me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have just like you had Hugo Strange taunting the city. Immediately you have Scarecrow taunting them. And it's not until you get the new suit that you're like, okay.
Yeah. Okay, and then the actual Batmobile comes into play and it kind of changes things up.
Yeah, that part really makes a difference.
Also, just for the record, I wanted to go ahead and point this out. Also, just for the record, I've also been playing Injustice, but I'll get to that in just a second. You brought up the thing with Batman and guns.
Yeah.
I was talking about this on the unfortunately not released Let's Weekend that unfortunately went bust Friday. But one of the things I've been reading, and I'll probably talk a lot more about this on the next Let's Weekend that hopefully will not implode, but I've been reading the Batman Chronicles. If you don't know what this is, guys, this is a series of trade paperbacks that DC has released for their legacy characters that basically they collect the earlier comics for many of their big characters in sequential order. So, like, they've got a Chronicle series for Superman with Siegel and Schuster. They got ones for Wonder Woman with William Moulton Marston. They got the ones with, you know, both Green Lanterns, The Flash with Gardner Fox. You know, they got all that. Now, here's the thing. You were bringing up the thing with guns. Now, when you think about Batman's character, his thing with guns makes sense because, you know, remember, his parents were killed with a gun. So obviously that's a bit of there's a bit of trauma related with that. And the thing is, though, that's bullshit. Because in the earliest Batman stories, Batman had a gun and used it twice.
Right. But
even killed a guy with it.
But well, he also had snapped somebody's neck before too. But like that interpretation of the character is not the one that's relevant now.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, because I remember I watched the Batman 89 movie and I was 8 years old. And I remember when he shot the doors off Ace Chemicals, I was like, Batman doesn't use what? Why did mom? Why does the Batmobile have guns on it? She's like, just watch the movie and shut up. So I feel like
in that thing, he was using the guns non-lethally. He was using
he was blowing the door off.
Yeah.
So no, I understand that, but also if you like want to be a stickler for the way it used to be in the old comics, he had purple gloves.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, there's all kinds of changes and stuff that matter, but for the more modern interpretation of the character, it makes sense that he doesn't use guns. But then also at the same time, if you know, with the way Arkham Knight has a way of presenting Batman in a very and really all of the Arkham games is very, very, very dark. I would say arguably a lot more dark than the comics have been over the last few years.
From what I've been told, as you get towards the end of the game, they start sort of deconstruct the whole Batman mythos.
And I will you start say this. I'm not going to ruin it for anybody, but that as far as the way the game works and as far as like sort of going into why Batman does what he does, there. Once you get to about the midway point, it starts to get just utterly fascinating. And
here's the thing: people always forget, I think, about Batman, because everybody seems to think of Batman as this sort of wish fulfillment power fantasy at its most puerile. And to some extent, on occasion, that can be true. But the thing is, people always forget one very crucial aspect about Batman, and that is this. Bruce Wayne is insane. Like, he's he's a high-functioning and very rich insane, but he's not mentally well by any stretch of the imagination. That's okay, but let me make my case.
No, you're wrong. The end.
No, Bruce Wayne, but Bruce Wayne's even though he is now well into adulthood, he has all this money and he has this thing, you know, the thing is mentally that night when he was in that rainy alley near the theater when Joe Chill shot his parents, he's in many ways, he's still stuck in that moment all of these years later. And what that's done to him is that it's created this – not just this extreme paranoia and serious trust issues. It's also made it that he's almost got this addiction to vigilantism. He is compelled to do what he is because no matter how much he does, how much money he makes, how many criminals he puts in jail, no amount of bruises or broken bones is ever going to make up for the fact that his parents are gone. And once you finally realize that this is who Batman is, but that he is – that once you start to realize that the guy behind the mask is basically this PTSD-addled wreck, it kind of makes the whole Batman facade actually kind of depressing.
Wow, that's incredibly depressing in and of itself. You're wrong, and here's why. Batman, and I could appreciate that way to look at it, but the thing that I think everybody misses, and I think it's what people miss when they say stuff like, well, how come Batman just doesn't kill the Joker? I mean, look at everything that he's done. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, the core of that character, when you strip away the mask, you strip away the gadgets, you strip away anything, the core of that character is he is a person who doesn't want to see anyone else die. Whether that's a criminal, whether that is a kid whose parents are wandering down an alley, it doesn't matter. To him, that's the that fundamental line that was crossed is what created him. If anything, I would say he is the furthest thing away from sane, because he literally takes up, like, and of course, I'm also talking purely from the comics point of view. You can look at this through the different lens of the different versions of media that he's been in. But the character at the core of it is somebody who doesn't want to see anybody else die. And he's also working outside of a system that is fundamentally broken. Like, they touch on this a little bit in the early in the Batman Begins movies, and sort of to a certain extent in The Dark Knight. But it's especially apparent in the comics. Gotham is insanely corrupt. The reason why Bruce Wayne has such a relationship with Commissioner Gordon is because Commissioner Gordon is not corrupt. And like, if you read,
he's basically the only guy in the Gotham police force who isn't corrupt.
Whereas, because Bruce is a billionaire, if it was just a matter of throwing money to get more cops on the street to make people safe, that's what would be done. But that won't work in that city. Like, they did an issue at one point where Superman came to Gotham and tried to help Batman clean it up, and Superman fundamentally failed on every single level because he didn't operate the way Batman does. He operated with the idea that every city is like Metropolis, and it's not. And the thing to remember about Gotham is really a reflection of late 70s and early 80s New York, where everything was porn and corruption and cops being on the take and everything else like that. So he is a character that is doing what he has to do based on the thing that drives him, because no one else around him will do it. And I think that's the furthest thing from insane. But this is a video game podcast, so we should probably cover this on another one. We could argue about this all day long, I think.
We'll probably do – if you can show up for the Let's Weekend this week, we'll probably talk about it more.
Okay.
But anyway, other than that, I've been playing Injustice, the Ultimate Edition, which has all the DLC characters. And I played through the single-player mode with Scorpion, which is one of the – DLC characters, and Pat's right. It's not the Scorpion you think it is. He looks like Scorpion. He sounds like Scorpion. His moves list is like Scorpion, but he is not Scorpion.
Nope.
He is, in fact, one of Trigon's demons who thinks he's Scorpion. But that's what I've been doing.
Great job with the design too.
Oh yeah. Well, Jim Lee's a freaking awesome dude anyway.
Yeah.
Like, he's the one dude from the Image days that actually has any real talent. That's right, I said it.
Okay.
Screw you, Todd McFarlane.
Damn. Shots fired. See, you're going to turn this podcast into something it shouldn't be.
He's going to drop his mic. That's what he's going to do.
Okay.
Anyway. I'm just kidding. I actually do like Spawn, so. But that's what I've been doing. So, Teresa?
Me? I have been marathoning freaking Civilization like nobody's business.
Isn't that what you usually do?
Yeah, but, like, really bad. Really, really bad. I had to soak my hand in a hot tub that bad.
Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah, I need to move over to controller because, ow. So, right now I'm torn. I thought about getting ESO.
You're torn or something in your hand is?
No, it's me. Okay. Nothing in my hand could possibly be torn anymore. It's just trashed. It's been trashed since I was 19. Come on, you guys know my pain. So I'm torn between going to ESO next or returning to Final Fantasy XIV.
You know what decision I support?
Yeah, well, one is paid for but requires a subscription, and the other can be gotten at an okay price and doesn't require a subscription. So, yeah, I don't know where I'm going next.
I'm not going to be playing either. I have friends that have told me to jump into Final Fantasy, and I've had friends that are like, yo, man, you seriously got to come play ESO. And I'm like, no, I'm good. I don't need anything else.
Time suck. I really should skip both and work on my pile of shame.
Yeah. I'm actually really interested in Final Fantasy, but I play MMOs with my wife. So that's the other thing. Like, so if she'll try out one of those, then I'll totally do it. But otherwise I can't.
So now I know who to put the sales pitch to.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
What have you been playing, Lee?
Well, I finished Arkham Knight. Like I said, I 100%ed it.
Oh yeah, that's right. You did say that.
Yeah, I was disappointed with the ending, to be honest. Simply because it narratively it goes in some interesting directions, like particularly towards the end of the game, like we were saying a few minutes ago, there's some really interesting stuff, like where you get down into the psyche of Batman, that's really, really fascinating. But the way that they leave it, like they do something that the comics haven't done, which I think is really cool. But the problem is that it almost what they did at the end of Arkham Knight makes sense if it was the second game in the series and not the finale. I played the Batgirl DLC. I was disappointed in that.
I've been told that the Batgirl DLC is not up to snuff. I've been told it's not necessarily that the character is bad. It's that just the mission that they give you is just really, really bland and basic.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It actually feels like really just combat missions and like, you know how you'd have those combat challenges? It feels like a combat challenge just in a more wide open area. And it's cool. Like, it's cool being able to play with Batgirl. Like, her character model is rendered really well. She uses the Catwoman animation set. And you know, if you've seen Catwoman,
which kind of makes sense.
They're not going to make a whole new animation set, but they.
And for the record, this Batgirl, this is pre-Oracle Barbara Gordon, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's before the idea of
it's
it
before the Joker paralyzed her. Yeah,
yeah, it's supposed to be before Arkham Asylum, actually.
Yeah,
and but
well,
yeah,
I mean, she was already the Oracle before Arkham Asylum, so.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, in terms of like the actual like time game timeline is what.
Yeah.
I mean. So, just
so you guys know, the stuff that happened in the Killing Joke is actually canon to the Batman Arkham games.
Yeah.
More or less.
It's a cool DLC, but I feel like if, you know, we've talked a lot about the pricing, right, of a lot of this stuff, and it's like a $7 piece of DLC, it's not bad. I don't know that it's worth $7, but I also don't feel ripped off. But the problem with it is that if that is indicative of what the season pass is, then it's going to be problematic because, like, I know from what I'm told and what I've read, a good chunk of the DLC is going to be like these small story based things, and that's fine. Whatever. I realize they couldn't design like an expansion, but I honestly think that they are probably for half of that DLC that they're charging $40 for, that it's going to be this, the Batgirl, which is essentially like a Batgirl, like challenge mode. They're going to give out the Red Hood DLC that was, you could get through GameStop. They're going to give out the Scarecrow stuff. And then they're going to give out the Harley Quinn stuff and then maybe do one or two more things. So essentially, the way it looks currently is that Season Pass is going to basically be all the pre-order stuff and then maybe one or two bonus things and then a bunch of skins. So and I think that they probably – I think looking at the way it's been presented, that's probably exactly how it was going to go. I mean, if you guys remember when they announced it, they announced the $40 season pass. They just said it's going to be 6 months worth of content. We still have no details really whatsoever about what the next thing is going to be. I think the only thing they recently announced was the Batman 89 skin with the Batmobile. But I'm calling it here. We're going to probably get one or two, maybe more story modes that are actually legitimately made. And they'll be short, and they probably won't be worth the price of admission. And then the rest of the season pass is going to be the DLC that they already released as pre-order stuff. And if that really does turn out to be the case, that's really kind of scummy.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Because skins is here's the thing. If there was ever a game where skins should be unlocked, it's this stuff. I mean, there's so much history with not just Batman, but with all of the characters, with Batman, with Robin, Nightwing, Catwoman, his villains. Could you imagine if you actually went through the game and you could play, like if they did an animated series skin pack and every single villain that you have in the game had their animated series skin stuck on it? It would look a little weird to mesh that with the world, but people would buy that. Or if you could imagine if somebody could do like set it as like the way the villains looked in the 40s, like that kind of stuff. Like if there was ever a character in a game that screamed out for like new skins and everything else like that to really be earnable rather than buyable, it's really Batman. Because as fun as Arkham Knight is, I could see myself going through it maybe one more time, but that's it. And skins aren't enough, I think, to make people really hold on to the game. Mm. So I'll be curious to see how they do the DLC. But that's been the big thing. I finished that up yesterday. And, of course, you know, doing Star Wars and all that stuff. But, yeah, it's totally worth playing. I don't think it's worth doing 100% of the stuff to get the real ending, particularly since the real ending is just, like, it adds, like, maybe another 2 minutes and 30 seconds, and you're still left in the same damn place anyway.
Yeah.
So, but it's definitely worth playing. Anybody that is interested in it, it's a lot of fun. The Batmobile complaints also go away if you're not stuck doing every single last side mission, because then you're not doing nearly as much as in the Batmobile. And the Batmobile is a lot of fun. For the people that have complained about it, like, I get why if you're 100%ing the game, it does get a little bit old, because Rocksteady's not good at boss battles. And so they substitute a lot of boss battles for the Batmobile stuff. But, oh, my God, driving around the city and hearing criminals freak out and go, oh, my God, it's the Bat. And then you can hop out of the Batmobile and kick him in the necks. Come on, man. That's like serene. So,
something else about the game I'm really loving right now are the Riddler challenges. The ones where you're having to do them to a free Catwoman from that thing around her neck.
Yeah. Yeah, so really, you guys should all play the game. It's worth $60. It's one of the few games that I would buy at full price. It's definitely worth the money.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay. So, what should be no news to anybody at this point is the sad passing of Nintendo's president Satoru Iwata. We found out about this shortly after we finished recording last week's Day Zero update. And
awkward.
Yeah, it was kind of strange.
Yeah, we ended on kind of a funny note last week, and then, I work overnights on my on the job that pays the bills for me, and so normally after we do the show, I'll wind down a little bit and then head to bed, and I just remember getting up to go to the bathroom, probably three or so hours after we recorded, and I had a message on my phone from Danrib just saying, you know, holy shit, Iwata died. And it didn't really register at first. I was still in that place between awake and not awake. It didn't register, but once I came back, I saw it again. And what? How? And I got on Facebook, and it was just all over. Like, it was the only thing that anyone was talking about on Facebook, and it was surreal.
Yeah.
And
for those of you who don't know, what he passed away from a gallbladder tumor, and so cancer, basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this kind of actually puts sort of how he's looked over the last couple of years into perspective. If you've seen him over the last couple of years when he, you know, did an Ask Iwata thing on YouTube, you start to notice that he starts to look a bit more haggard and seems to be getting thinner.
Gaunt.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, if you look at Iwata in the last couple of years, and then look at say Steve Jobs in 2009, 2010, the similarities are very, very eerie.
Yeah,
they are.
Yeah. Hmm. And then now we start to sort of understand why it is he hadn't shown up at E3 the last couple of times, because he had been dealing with this.
And what it was he was really asking us to understand.
Yeah,
that kind of doesn't make that so funny anymore, does it?
Yeah.
No. Awkward again.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm glad that... In a way, I'm glad that the news didn't break while we were doing the show, and it didn't
end up happening. Yeah.
That's not something I really would have wanted to cover in the moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy that that we had a week to kind of reflect on it and digest what has gone on. But this is a blow to the industry. We lost
ones. I mean, this guy wasn't just an executive. This guy came out of Nintendo's development world. You know, this guy was a very good developer and programmer. If any of you out there enjoy Earthbound as much as I do, you have Mr. Iwata to thank, because when it seemed all was lost and that game was going to end up being vaporware, he single-handedly programmed the entire thing. Yeah. Like, pretty much from the ground up.
Yeah, he was as far as programming, he was a boss. Like, I read for, I think it was Pokemon, was it Gold? I think. He basically, like, their code was so bloated that they were worried about fitting the map in there, and they actually wow. had him asked him to help out, and he did, and he went back and he saved them so much space they were actually able to put the region from Pokemon Blue and Red into the game because of how much space he had saved.
Yeah,
I'll be right back.
And this okay. This and really this is sort of part of the reason why in many ways he made such a much better CEO than Yamauchi was, because he actually came out of that area. This guy was a developer and a programmer before he became an executive. And he understood all of the problems that go along with it, and he was able to, you know, he understood the development cycle better.
Yeah, but not only that, though, he was a very firm believer in the fact that a game should be fun.
Yeah.
It could have a very simple concept, but it's something that has to grab you. And pretty much, well, across the board, all the games that he's ever worked on have had that in common. I mean, I can't tell you how many hours I've spent playing Balloon Fight. You know,
right.
It was like a Joust clone, but it sort of wasn't.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, and really, I mean, if you look at it that way, I mean, one of the most interesting things about that gentleman was that, like, you know, people have heard me like rail against Nintendo a lot, but the one thing that I can't ever really rail against is the quality of what they produce. And we've actually talked about that on this show before, where it's like, you know, despite whatever they may be doing, at least their stuff is fun. And that's like the core component of every Nintendo game is like, is this fun? And I feel like as a CEO, he really was responsible for continuing that on Nintendo's level, because you can look at what's wrong with the Wii U. And there are a lot of things wrong with it. But the one thing that's not wrong with it is the games. The ones that Nintendo have produced, they're all extremely fun. Look at the stuff with the DS. Same thing. Like, I mean, particularly on the DS under his watch, they put out so many games that I think if we were at a different time, would have never come out. And you know, I felt like he really... he was really exemplary of what Nintendo was about, like at the highest, I guess, like ideal. Like when we were kids, he was what Nintendo was about, or what we thought it was about, even though it was being run by Yamauchi. And when you look at what they've done really over the last 10 or 15 years, I mean, that's partly because of him. And I remember reading a quote when Nintendo, when it was going really, really bad for Nintendo, I remember reading a quote by him where he said, like, Wall Street and all these other investors were calling for him to start laying people off. And he was like, and he instead, he took a pay cut and he said, no, we're not going to lay anybody off, because if we do that, then people are going to be in fear of their jobs. And if they are in mm-hmm. fear of their jobs, they're not going to be able to create something incredible. No one can be creative when they're terrified. And that's probably something, I'm not sure how other Japanese businesses work. But I do know, you know, having been in the corporate world in America, that that is an extremely rare thing, and very few, if any, CEOs have that same mentality. If you look at, I mean, hell, you can look at anything that's been going on in this country since we had the, where we almost fell into a depression in 2008. People that are on top don't give a crap about the people on the bottom for the most part. And he was the complete opposite of that. And I think that that's why, under his watch, good or bad, Nintendo was still able to produce the kind of games that they have done. I mean, like, if you, any of you guys have played Super Mario 3D World, like, I played that with my kid, and it's just joyful. It's joyful. It's a joyful game. And I think what worries me about his passing is, regardless of whoever is at Nintendo, whatever missteps that they're making, Nintendo is not a developer that I want to see exit the industry, because in a lot of ways, I think if Nintendo wasn't here, the industry would literally just be a cynical cesspool of tech demos.
Yeah.
You know? And it would be, you know, look how many polygons we put in this hair, rather than look at how fun this is. You know? And so I'm a little worried about the direction. Obviously, they still have a lot of other people over at the company that still believe in the things that they do. But
yeah,
it's a little nuts. It's one of those things that concerns me. But yeah, fun. That's what it's about. And then and he just – that it's just so amazing to me for him to be like, yeah, I'm not going to make – I want to make sure no one gets laid off. I'm going to take a pay cut. You're gonna pay me a dollar this year.
Yeah.
And we're going to figure this out. Like, how selfless is that? And you know,
like I said earlier, like, part of the reason he was able to do that is because, yeah, he, like I said, he came out of the development area to become the CEO. He knows how the difficulties and everything that goes along with that. Yeah. And because of that, he was better to empathize much more strongly with the people working under him.
Right, and that's what's so interesting about that, because that's typically not how it works.
Yeah. No.
What else is fascinating too? I remember the best story I read about him after he had passed away was, I don't even remember what game he was working on, but apparently he had rigged something up with the GBA where it had a motion sensor, like they put a motion sensor in a cartridge pack, and he was figuring out how that would work and how that would be like an interesting thing for people to interact with. And apparently at one point he became so enamored with what they could figure out and, you know, what they could do with it, that he started inviting people into his office, and he would set the GBA in his office chair and he would spin it around. And they got it to sync up with some music that was playing across the room. And so here's the president of this company, you know, like the man, running out into the hallway going, you guys got to see this. And then running in, spinning his chair around, and then giggling about it.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
And also, let's also remember, unlike Yamauchi, Iwata was the first Nintendo CEO to really put himself out there as the face of the company.
Yeah,
you know, he became something of a cult figure almost solely because of his Iwata Asks segments that he would do. You know, and it's because of that I think, not amongst other things, people are taking his death pretty hard.
And I want to follow that line of thought too, because a lot of people, like, you know, Yamauchi didn't really make himself the public face of the company, but through literature and news articles, his legacy, whatever it might, however you might see it, is well documented. When he passed away, it must have been 2 or 3 years ago now. You know, you saw a couple of token news blurbs on gaming websites, or even some mainstream news sites. You saw a couple.
Nobody mourned Yamuchi the way they're doing this. Yamuchi was the stereotype of like the ruthless Japanese businessman. I mean, if you guys read about what he did to Namco and everything else like that in the 80s, Yamuchi was not a loved person.
No,
he was an incredibly shrewd. Yeah, he was an incredibly shrewd businessman, but nobody liked
it. But with Iwata, on the other hand.
Yeah, with Iwata, there was just been this global outpouring of love and support, and you know, and just emotion. And I mean, you have these memorials going up at Nintendo of America headquarters in Redmond, at the Nintendo World Store in New York City. I read something about Russian fans going and setting up a memorial at the Japanese embassy in Moscow. This is a stark contrast. I mean, the more people were talking, the more detailed the Yamauchi articles were. They were, I mean, some of those writers got pretty close to saying "Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead," and you know, this is the polar opposite of that. And I think just. And the way we've all been feeling it, just, I mean, some of the conversations I've had with you guys over the last week have, you know, really helped, you know, drive that home with, from my own perspective. It's been something we really have to digest.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And the basic speculation that goes now is who is going to replace him. Most of what I've heard is that probably Takeda is going to be the one who's going to take his position.
I think it has to be.
You know, because there's also a chance Miyamoto could. Yeah, but Miyamoto just couldn't do it. He's too deeply ingrained in his projects right now that he just does not have the time.
Yeah. More to the point, I think if he actually wanted that job, he would have been Yamauchi's successor and not Iwata.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that was his job for the taking if he wanted it.
Yeah, he doesn't want it. You know, you can't look at something like this and not think that they had a succession plan going already.
Yeah.
I mean,
we knew, they've known, you know, the people at Nintendo headquarters have known about, you know, Iwata's health problems for a while. Granted, they kept it secret, but they were aware that, you know, this could be a potentially fatal thing, so I would not be surprised if they already have his successor picked already.
Yeah,
he probably had a hand in picking his successor.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's one thing. Having worked for a Japanese company, I understand they have contingency plans always.
Yeah,
contingency plans on contingency plans on contingency plans.
Yeah,
to a degree. Yeah.
And just so let me just posit something for you guys. Because whenever we've seen Iwata make appearances, granted it's been few and far between as of lately, but in the past, who has he always been seen with?
Reggie and Miyamoto.
Yeah. We know that Miyamoto really doesn't want that job. I mean, at this point, Miyamoto is probably a couple of years away from retiring and having a nice, cushy retirement.
Right.
I get the sense that they might actually put Reggie in charge of the whole shebang.
Fuck, I hope not.
No. Well, there was something interesting.
I'm honestly not sure. I be honest, knowing how Japanese business, having something of an idea of how Japanese business worked, I do not see that happening.
And there was something interesting that I saw in the death notice, or whatever you want to call it, that that Takeda released to announce Iwata's passing. It mentioned that Iwata was the CEO of Nintendo of America as of the middle of 2013.
Really?
Yep. So, if anything, Reggie may have just been a talking head for the last 2 years.
That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, that's really... Reggie almost feels in a lot of ways like damage control.
Well, he's a pitch man. I mean, that was what they got him for, and that was what his whole career has been. But he is very effective as a public face. I'll say that much.
Plus, you know, he does believe in the same core concepts that Iwata did.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The possibility is there. Whether they'll do it or not,
we'll have to see. I doubt we'll have to wait too much longer till we find out who Iwata's successor is going to be. And I think most of us...
They'll have to make a move, because when you have so many people invested in a company, like monetarily, this is not something they can just let sit, because money, you know, when you have people investing money into your company, you always have a boss.
So
more than likely, I think we're agreed that more than likely it's going to be Takeda who's going to take his place.
Either Takeda or if they're really, really strange, they'll put Reggie at the top.
Knowing what I know about Japanese corporate culture, is a almost zero to none chance of that happening.
I got a feeling by next week we'll probably have all of the details sorted.
You think maybe they could talk Arakawa into coming back?
Ooh, well. Here's the problem with any of these guys that are being mentioned. They're old.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's really the core of it. They are old.
Arakawa was 68.
Yeah, and so it does come down to is this, do we hand this? Because that's the other thing. I think when you look at Nintendo's position in the market as well, the board, don't forget there's a board that's going to be interested in who gets appointed, and they vote on that.
Yeah.
So,
which is why Reggie won't get it.
Right. Well, there also might be a group of people that are like, you know what? Iwata, being what he was to everybody, still didn't matter with Nintendo's financial troubles this time around. So as much as he might be loved, there is a group of people, myself included, that somewhat feel like, he was part of the problem with Nintendo being so slow moving. And not even... I mean, they're still competing like it's 2005.
Yeah.
And that has hurt them tremendously. And unfortunately, they're in a place where they can't just do things the way that they want to do them. They have investors that they're responsible to. So I would not be surprised if, they do obviously put someone in the position that's like old school Nintendo, but also someone that is a lot more forward about, we need to make this... We need to bring Nintendo into the 21st century, because they really haven't been for a very long time. It's a shame too, because it felt like Nintendo was finally realizing that right before Iwata died. I mean, you have the stuff with DNA, them actually trying to figure out, stuff that we feel should be standard, things like an account system and everything else like that. And, I think it would really benefit Nintendo to have a more aggressive CEO that understands Nintendo's place in the market and how they could truly dominate if they competed. And, I'm curious, that's the other part of this, because, I always think about this stuff in the business sense. Like, what does this mean for Nintendo, particularly their corporate culture going forward? That's going to be very interesting to see, because this stuff matters.
Yeah, it does.
And that takes us to another possibility. And you mentioned the corporate culture. Going kind of off the board on this one. Not that Arakawa wouldn't be off the board too, but one of the Yamauchi grandkids.
I was gonna say that, but
yeah.
Yeah, because they're still out there. They gave it to Iwata when everyone thought it should go to one of Yamuchi's grandkids. So that is another possibility. I remember the way that people freaked out when they were like, whoa, the successor isn't going to be one of Yamuchi's, you know, family. That was a big deal back then.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And if they're the kind of grandkids who understood why their grandpa's company was awesome a lot more than their grandpa understood it. I mean, these are people probably growing up with Nintendo products all around them. Obviously, Hiroshi Yamauchi, he really begrudgingly took his company in the video gaming direction. I think he was out of touch with what made gaming what it is throughout his entire tenure. And just kind of left it up to the other guys, Miyamoto, Iwata, Yokoi, those guys, to really steer the ship. But the grandkids, the ones who grew up around that and, you know, in the gaming culture that their grandpa's company fostered, you know, now might be the time to get one of them in.
And 13 years ago when Iwata took over, I don't think that either of the grandkids would have been a good choice.
Yeah.
But now having 13 years of, you know, learning from Iwata himself, you know, to be able to take the best bits of what he did and their own experiences and knowledge, you know, that might happen and might be the best thing for Nintendo at this point.
Mm-hmm. It depends on what school of thought they're coming from.
Yeah.
But, well, I've just made my theory about the whole thing known. But that really seems to be the kind of dynamic that could have been going on over the years. You know,
I think that's a very Pat. I really think that that's a fantastic point because if you look at. Like let's take a step back on this for just a moment. Look at what's going on with the indie scene right now. Everything is 8-bit and 16-bit clones. Mm-hmm. And that's because not everything obviously, but that's because these are people that grew up playing Nintendo games. These are people that grew up loving this kind of stuff. And then now they're the ones making the game. So like when you like Axiom Verge is really the Metroid game we've all been asking for years. So, and that
was made with just one guy.
Right. But the thing is, to Pat's point, is that was made by someone that grew up and realized what made Nintendo games Nintendo games. And then he turned around because nobody else was producing that kind of thing, and he made that kind of game. So if you did have one of the grandchildren come in, that would make sense strictly on the point of they grew up with this stuff. They understood what made it special, and maybe that could be translated into getting Nintendo back on top. Because I'll be honest with you, as much as I like Sony and as much as I like Microsoft and everything else like that, there is nothing that would make me happier than having a dominant Nintendo.
A resurgent again. Nintendo, yeah.
It because if we had that in the industry, it would be amazing. Because I think that really, for the most part, the cycle that you saw last generation and what we're seeing now with devs closing and everything else like that, a lot of that stuff is happening because people are pursuing technology and not fun. And if you had a company like Nintendo that was back on top, like, dude, I would love for the days to come back when I had a Super Nintendo and I knew I could just buy one system. And, you know, I obviously had a Genesis at that point, too, because of Sega's games. But I would love to have a system that had all the third-party stuff and Nintendo's games. Like, because as it is now, like, I don't even play my Xbox One. My son plays my Xbox One. I play my PS4 because that's where my friends are, and the ports are superior. If Nintendo could pull out a piece of equipment like that that had the same support from third parties, that had games like Batman, Arkham Knight, and stuff on it, and the next-gen Nintendo stuff, a new Zelda, a new Metroid, I wouldn't have any reason to own anything else because I don't have the time to own anything else.
Oh, they would need one hell of an ambassador to third parties, though.
Right, and that's the problem. I think that, honestly, I think in a lot of ways that ship has probably sailed.
Yeah.
But with that said, that still doesn't mean that Nintendo couldn't be back in a position where they could be relatively dominant in the market again. They just hopefully whoever the CEO is can come in. Because I also let's also be straight on the point. Iwata obviously knows what made Nintendo games special because of the stuff that he was involved in, but he was not aware of everything else outside of it. And maybe that was his failing as a businessman. You know, is not looking at the competition and going, you know, what are these guys doing? But then, you know, the counterpoint to that is that he also oversaw the DS when everyone said the DS would fail, and he oversaw the Wii. And if you look at sales figures alone, the Wii is obviously a smashing success. I think it's arguable as a game system what its position is, but and that was their other misstep. I think they looked at the Wii and they went, we figured out the formula, and it obviously was not the formula. So, but yeah, I think Pat, to bring it back around to your point, maybe, you know, maybe having Yamuchi's grandchildren in there and having a person that existed when this stuff, when they, these types of special things existed when they were kids.
Yes.
That's the kind of person that should probably run that company.
And yeah. See, that's what I'm picturing. I'm picturing, obviously Hiroshi Yamauchi himself just being kind of out of touch and grudgingly going along with it because it's printing money. Meanwhile, you've got the grandkids growing up surrounded by this, the Nintendo culture, the gaming culture, and they probably didn't need any explanation whatsoever why it was awesome. And that could go a long way.
Yeah. So, final thoughts on Iwata before we move on?
It's damn sad.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. Bottom line, it was a sad thing to have happen. And I do think that watching how Nintendo behaves going forward is gonna be very interesting, because there's honestly not a worse time that he could have passed away.
Yeah. So I also think this kicks the NX back a ways. They're going to be married to the Wii U for a little while, whether they want to be or not.
Yeah, I disagree there, but that's another conversation. I still stick to what I said. The NX is coming out by Christmas of next year. Yeah. Because their market position has eroded so badly that there's no other way that something like that couldn't happen. So, but yeah, it's sad. And hopefully Nintendo's corporate culture does not suffer. Yeah. But I love Earthbound, so I love Iwata.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, moving on from somebody who is much...
Now that we got the depressing stuff out of the way, why don't we talk about something like a Middle Eastern exit strategy or, you know, abortion?
Oh, gosh.
No?
No.
I figured that would lighten the mood.
Well, it would, but...
How about the Confederate flag? We can talk about that for a while.
There's a lot of stuff we could... Let's try and get more positive and upbeat now, guys.
Okay. Let's go from somebody that, you know, was universally loved... Well, not so much universally, but well-loved, to somebody that is almost completely universally hated and is fun to just rag on for a while. Mr. Derek Smart. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and just explain, because I'm not sure if I'm the only one here who actually knows who this guy was.
Yeah, this is in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, okay, so if you were a PC gamer in the 90s and were on Usenet at any point, there is more than a good chance that you were familiar with Derek Smart, no matter how much you wish that wasn't true. But Derek Smart is infamous for a couple of things. One of them is the fact that he spent 10 years working on a single project. He said that this project was going to be the ultimate space simulation game, just the ultimate. It was going to be a big space simulator where you got to control a giant dreadnought of a ship. And it would have elements of things like, you know, it would have elements of real-time strategy and first-person shooters, flight simulator, material management, just all these elements all into one game.
This sounds exactly like something I would not want to play anymore.
Yeah. Hold on just a second, guys.
Sounds like a giant
guys.
Cluster F to me.
Yeah, hold on just a second, guys.
Mm-hmm. I guess Brandon's getting a running start for what he's about to say.
Yeah.
It's probably a good thing. But I'm about to let him have it. Just give me 20 feet.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, I'm back, guys. Sorry about that.
Okay. So I think you were about to...
Yeah.
So Derek Smart, you got a running start to insult him.
Yeah, and, you know, I said his game was going to have all these aspects. It took him 10 years to work on this thing. And the thing was, halfway, he actually got funding and a team to work under him. And even then, the game that finally came out, when it finally did came out, was a complete mess. This game was the infamous Battle Cruiser 3000 AD.
Oh, that was him. Oh, dear.
Yes, that was him.
Oh, boy.
This was a game that not only was buggy as all hell, it was also... It was so complicated, and the interface was so convoluted. You basically had to be an MIT grad to even attempt to play this thing.
Okay.
And, you know, yeah. Phil's is familiar with this particular atrocity.
I attempted to play it. I even attempted to play some of the patched versions that came out more recently. Those aren't much better.
Nope.
So what here's the thing. Been doing?
Well, here's the other thing. On top of the fact that he was hyping up this game that ultimately turned out to be a complete bomb, he also was ragging on every other developer in existence, basically saying that they were crap compared to him. That, you know, the game he was going to play was going to just blow everybody away. That, of course, did not happen.
Well, sounds like it certainly blew.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, Derek Smart is still very much in business. He has his own independent game studio, and he still produces games. They all suck, but he still manages to make pretty good, but do pretty good business. So, obviously, he has an audience. Now, this particular instance involves Star Citizen. Star Citizen, as everybody knows, is a space simulation game by Chris Roberts' son, or Chris Roberts, the guy who did Wing Commander. And you know this thing has gotten a boatload of cash on Kickstarter and since then. And the thing was, the people at Star Citizen's developer basically decided to return Derek Smart's investment because he had actually put up $250 on their Kickstarter. And the reason was, they said, is that Derek Smart was basically using his development and his, you know, being he had invested in it, meant he had access to things like, you know, he could speak directly with the developers and stuff. And it became really obvious really quickly that he was mostly doing this just so he could promote his own products.
Shocking.
Gentleman. Yeah, and so they ended up giving back all $250 to him. And in the meantime, Derek Smart has basically said that he's calling on the FTC to actually, you know, investigate Star Citizen's developers for fraud. Now, for the record...
What?
For the record, you know, questions about Star Citizen's status are completely valid. Because let's face it, with the amount of money that has been invested in them, obviously there's got to be a lot of overhead. And in their defense, they have been releasing content. Pretty good content, in fact. Granted, it's taken a while, but, you know, they are actually releasing stuff.
Yeah, this is not a vaporware game here.
No, this
is turning into something that's actually, you know, very quality. Even if I don't particularly agree with its pricing structure at the moment.
Yeah. The thing is, the actual end product apparently is just so huge that they have to release it in pieces.
Yeah.
But, you know, either way, they are delivering on their, or at least trying to, even if, you know, the pricing is a little over the top.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's really obvious that, you know, Derek Smark is just a dick. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. The guy has openly admitted that he just likes to troll people.
Yeah. So essentially what's happening is that Derek Smart is upset about the fact that Star Citizen is actually delivering on the promises that he made some 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, keep in mind, all the stuff that Star Citizen is doing, it's... If the whole project as a whole, when it finally comes to fruition, will basically be all the stuff he promised Battlecruiser is going to be.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be, there's going to be flight simulation, first-person shooter elements, you know, material management, you know, all this stuff that he said was in Battlecruiser, all that stuff is coming to fruition in Star Citizen, actually.
Yeah, he kind of is.
And keep in mind,
when he tried to capitalize on their success, he's salty because they called him out on it.
Yep.
Pretty much.
And keep in mind, you know, this is not just some guy who went into obscurity and then just came back with a vengeance. He's been doing crap like this for years.
Hmm. Well, I mean, if he's been doing that kind of stuff for years, I mean, do people realize that he's full of it? Like, is he treated as such?
Well, like I said, he still does pretty good business with his own independent studio, so he has his followers.
Yeah.
So he's really just one of those figures that's kind of like, he's around and he's controversial. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like he's sort of like a kind of a douchier version of Cliffy B. Because
With the exception that Cliffy B is actually a competent game designer.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Cliffy B is one of those people that, regardless how you look at it, he knows what he's doing. But the problem is like when you look at how he's like kind of shilled for Oculus and everything else like that, it feels so hollow simply because you know he's involved in the money for that. So
yeah.
You know, that was when you guys saw, you know, what was it, a year ago where Notch kind of recoiled on the whole Oculus thing because he had put in a lot of money just helping them with their Kickstarter. And he was like, so wait a minute, I was just basically, you guys basically just use my money and a whole bunch of other people's money so you could sell this to Facebook. Like, and that brought up a lot of questions. Like, I'm not sure how versed you guys are in a lot of the business aspects of this stuff, but typically the way that it works is when somebody invests money into a product, they do get some sort of equity in that product where they will have a return because they were investors. And what was crazier about that whole thing is that people like Cliffy B put money into Oculus and got paid out when Oculus got bought by Facebook. Yeah, and that's a really big conflict of interest. It's really shady.
Yeah.
And you know, he was out there, you know, pimping it like, this is the greatest thing ever, blah, 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 blah. And... But you know, part of the reason he did that is because he got paid, and that's why.
Maybe the greatest thing ever that he was talking about was going home and counting up all the money that he got from.
Yeah, and if you've noticed, he hasn't been talking nearly as much because he got paid. You know.
Yeah,
he's too busy.
Well, he's working on. He's got his own studio now too.
Yeah. So. But
he's working on whatever
stuff like that is frankly is part of the reason too that people have such a distrust of a lot of people in the game industry, because you know, people, the one thing that I always sort of found insulting when people would talk about business, particularly the gaming side of it, is that the games industry is not different than a lot of other industries. There might be specific instances where the games industry is slightly different than another industry, but it's still entertainment, and companies still run the same way. You have to have capital. You have to have labor. You know, you have to be able to put out an end product that people want to buy. You have to put it out at a price that also brings profits back into your company so you can reinvest in it and so you can grow. Every business works that way. And it's sort of insulting in a lot of ways to look at the way the video game industry operates to be so antagonistic towards its own client base. Like, you don't see people that are like, for instance, the biggest thing I keep seeing lately is people talking about how we should be charged more money for games because how can these studios survive and everything else like that. Phil, you're going to bleep this. Fuck them. Because the problem with that is that we have nothing to do with any expanding margins anywhere at all. Now, to that point, I also want to say that I think that the way that video game designers are treated is really kind of crappy. But at the same time, they allow themselves in a lot of ways to be exploited, because for a lot of people, hell, look at the way we were guys back at GameX, and we weren't taken advantage of. We were all like, oh my God, we finally get to write about games and do this stuff in an industry that we love and everything else like that. And the bottom has fallen out for the most part when it comes to games journalism, because there's not enough money out there to really pay it the way that people pay for things, the way that people need so they can support themselves. And I think that what's happening in the games industry is almost similar in the sense that, like, when you look at the collapse of AAA gaming, part of that is happening is because they're overestimating the size of their audience. But the difference between video games and other industries, like, for instance, let's take perfect example, right? The movie industry. Now, obviously, the movie industry has a couple of other streams of revenue that the video game industry does not. However, no one is charging me $60 to go see The Avengers 2 because it costs $200 million. My ticket price still stays the same. And the video game industry is the only one that I've truly ever seen where people are completely willing to get screwed over with the idea in mind that, oh, but we're doing it's for the greater good. But the thing is people like this guy show that the greater good isn't for anything else. It's just so they can line their own damn pockets.
Yeah.
See, that actually makes me wonder what's going to happen when the AAA industry finally has its equivalent to Heaven's Gate.
See, I don't think collapse. I think what'll happen with
I'm not talking about the religious cult. I'm talking about the movie.
Okay. Well, I think what's going to happen
is I think either one could apply.
Yeah, but what's going to happen, though, is that they're going to shrink that stuff down. Because the interesting part to me about this is that – because, again, like, I'm more on the business side, I think, than you know, I want to play the latest game. Like, I'm more interested in the moving parts now. And what's fascinating to me is that you constantly see developers talking about the gamers are pushing for more and more. And you can go to forums like NeoGAF where you will have people say with a straight face, if this game isn't 1080p and 60 frames a second, it's unplayable. But the thing is, those people are a minority. And the reason that they're a minority is because we all know that gameplay trumps everything else. If it didn't, Minecraft wouldn't be pretty much the second biggest selling game of all time. And it looks terrible.
Yeah.
You know, like I always felt like it was disingenuous to have these developers go, well, it's the people want all this stuff. Yes, some of them might. But I'm not sitting there counting how many triangles it took to make Batman's cowl in Arkham Knight. And then the worst part about that, too, for these guys is the return on investment for the graphics technology becomes smaller and smaller and smaller every generation. And so what it's really done is it's exposed these development houses that are more interested in producing something that's technically amazing than something that's technically fun. And that's another problem that the industry is going through, and that's why people don't want to pay $60 for games. Yeah. Like Ubisoft is a perfect example of this, and I almost thought Arkham City, when I played it for the first hour, was going to fall into the same thing as what I call checklist gaming. I mean, if you noticed, everything these days is an open world, and it's got to have this, and it's got to have that, and it's got to have blah, 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 blah. None of that stuff's actually fun.
No.
None of it is. And that's why, like, Brandon, when you even mentioned, like, what this game was supposed to do, it's like, oh, my God, I might as well get a second job. Like, that's crazy. And the thing is, they're saying that gamers are asking for this, but they're not. They're not. There's so many examples to the contrary that this isn't the case.
Yeah.
And to tie it back to Nintendo, that's why I'm really curious the way that they're going to go. Because as much as I talk about how I wish Nintendo could compete, there's also the possibility that if they do that, they overshoot way, way too far, and they become the exact same thing that we don't like about all these other companies.
Yeah. Yeah, and like taking it back to Star Citizen for a minute, that's, yeah, okay, it's going to have all of this stuff, but that's the really brilliant thing about it is because it has all this stuff, you can focus, you can have a laser focus on just the stuff you want. If you want, if you're, you know, into, you know, trading routes, you could, you know, buy a trading ship and do that. If you like mercenary missions on the surface of planets, you do the first person module and you go for that. You know, it gives people a real, you know, a lot of options on what they can do. And they don't have to experience all of that content. It's there for them, but they don't have to.
Right. And, you know, it's funny you mention that, Phil, because that's the core problem that's going on with WoW right now. Is they produce a bunch of stuff that was not fun, and they've convinced themselves that everybody that plays that game has to see that stuff. Yeah. And they locked a feature that everybody expected the game to have behind essentially what is a chores list that basically said you have to go out and do all of these things in order to get this thing that you want, rather than them fixing what is fundamentally wrong with the gameplay of the game.
Yeah.
So, and they're a company that I never thought would be part of the problem, yeah. But they are.
Yeah, everybody so, makes mistakes.
No, they've – but it's – I think at this point with Blizzard, it's almost consistent. I mean, you look at what they did with Diablo 3. Now they've done the same thing with WoW. But then they turn around and they put out something awesome like Heroes of the Storm. But I also don't doubt that, you know – well, I don't know. They just – they – Blizzard has a – Blizzard actually has a very interesting team dynamic in the same way that the R&D departments from Nintendo do, where you there definitely sometimes feels like there's a pretty big difference between the A team and the B team. Mm-hmm. And like the A team isn't working on WoW anymore. Yeah. They're not there. The A team got switched over. They were on Heroes of the Storm and then they got switched over to Overwatch. Yeah. So.
There's that. Okay. So Derek Smart, are we done with him yet?
Please.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so let's talk about lots of money and Shenmue 3 making it.
Yeah. Well, I said on the show that Bloodstained's reign was going to be a short one. And
you were right.
I was right by about $1 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
It closed at what, six and a half million?
$6,333,295 from 69,320 donors.
Yeah. So, yeah, people want Shenmue.
People desperately want Shenmue.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Sure.
With Shenmue in mind and Kickstarter and everything, how many Kickstarters have you guys contributed to?
Two or three.
Successfully?
Just in general.
Yeah.
I've contributed a couple.
All right, how many of those have you actually received something from?
Let's see. Well, the one that didn't fund, I didn't receive anything for.
I was going to say, when one funds, I'll let you know.
When they don't fund, they give you the money back.
Yeah,
well, no, I know. I'm familiar with how it works. I was just curious because that is actually something I've never done. I've never contributed to a Kickstarter. I actually thought about contributing to Igarashi's. I think I'm at the point now as a consumer of anything that I'm sort of like skeptical about anything. And like, you know, we were sitting here talking about, you know, games costing more and everything else like that. To me, a lot of this stuff feels like Kickstarters are really just a way to get people to pay more who are excited. And I do think that there's a place for them, but I was curious what you guys thought as far as like how much you've paid into and stuff like that, because I find myself almost like wanting to, like for instance, I wasn't interested in Shenmue simply because we talked about the edition issue a couple of podcasts ago. Yeah. But I could see myself doing it for types of games that I want, like something like Bloodstained. Yeah. But it's just one of those things where I'm like, I'm so skeptical now to put down $60 on anything that the idea of putting down, you know, that amount of money and then not seeing anything produced for 3 or 4 years,
yeah,
it's just something I can't do.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like, well, I just say pay attention to who you're donating to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you can donate to him in pretty good confidence. Koji Igarashi, you can donate to him pretty good confidence. Keiji Inafune, same thing. But for a good example of a Kickstarter game that has come to fruition and is pretty much completed now, I was talking about Yatagarasu at the top of the show. That was a Kickstarter game.
Yeah.
And
well, and I know Broken Age was, and they've delivered on that as well. But I was just curious, you know, I was curious since we've been talking about this stuff, we obviously the last two topics have been about that sort of crowdfunding thing. So I was curious how much, just personally, how you guys had done that. Cause it's just one of those things that as much as I like the idea of it, I still can't do it.
Yeah.
Drift Stage is the one thing that I've, donated to that actually funded, but it's still very much in development. We're just waiting the next, beta build.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's also because I haven't really seen any Kickstarter rewards that actually got me excited that weren't on some ridiculous tier.
Yeah. And that's another problem because all the really good stuff is on the ridiculous tiers.
Right.
Shenmue 3 is a good example of that too, because if they'd had some of the complete sets of this is going to sound silly, but if they'd had some of the complete sets of capsule toys on a lower price tier than it would take to get the complete set, I would have been in on that.
Honestly, if they had done a tier that got me some sailors, I'd have probably done it. Or something I could pet a cat with.
Do you know where there are sailors? Do you know where? Do you know places where any sailors like to hang out?
Yeah.
I'm looking for some sailors.
But I think that's the other thing is that if I'm going to contribute to that stuff, I obviously want some sort of really something that's like, you know, that's essentially special. I don't care if it's an in-game skin or anything else like that. But I also am at the point like, okay, the asking price, like I'm at the point where I'm paying $30 or $40 for games rather than $60. So getting up into a tier that's like $100 to get something that actually is cool has me kind of like, well, I don't know. So I was just curious, since, you know, like I said, we've been sitting here talking about it. I was curious how much you guys had done, because I want to stress, I actually think Kickstarter is a wonderful thing for the industry, and it's obviously something that's necessary, because if we didn't have that stuff, a lot of these things wouldn't be getting made.
And just looking at some of the things that it's made possible,
tells you
how great it is.
Conversely, though, I contributed to the Kickstarter for Retronauts. And I actually contribute to their Patreon because I like Retronauts. But to me, that's a different sort of product being delivered. I don't have to wait 3 or 4 years for it. Yeah, so, you know, that's a little bit different. So, okay, cool. I'm sorry for the side note. I was just curious.
Yeah. No, that's a good conversation, actually. I would say that my personal Kickstarter experience has been inconclusive, just because I've donated to so few things.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as Patrick here.
Yeah. But
it's just interesting topic, because I think about that guy that we talked about on the show a couple of weeks back, who basically – I don't remember what the game was, so I apologize. I don't have any of the information in front of me. But he basically got a Kickstarter started for a game, and then he basically took the money and ran. And he was the first person that's actually being sued by the FCC now with the whole Kickstarter format. So that is – I'm really curious to see how that moves forward, because I guess that's the other part of it for me, is it's like, at least if I'm putting down my money, whatever the money is, when I purchase a game, I have the thing in my hands. If I don't like it, I can do something with it. Yeah. But the idea that, you know, I might not be able to do that because I'm basically putting down a pre-order 4 years in advance.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just something that doesn't sit right with me.
Yeah.
Well, another thing you got to keep in mind with Kickstarters as well is oftentimes the release dates reported on Kickstarter do not reflect the reality. And the reason that you'll see these really super conservative release dates, expected fulfillment dates, whatever, is just them playing CYA and, you know, not putting themselves in a position where they're promising a release timetable that's unrealistic. They'd rather get you the product ahead by a year than behind by a year.
It's a typical under promise over deliver. But for me, like, part of the way that I look at it too, as well, is that, you know, that, like, that's something that I do in my job. And, you know, you under promise and you over deliver. That way, if, you know, you do, frankly, if you screw up, nobody's, you know, trying to hang you for it. But the, I guess, sort of like the thing that I look at too with this stuff is, to take it back to show how old I am, Halo 2. I don't know if you guys remember when that was getting ready to be launched.
I love bees.
Huh?
I love bees.
Yeah, I love bees. Mm-hmm. But the funny part about the whole thing that happened with Halo 2 was that when you looked at their E3 demo and you actually looked at, like, the behind-the-scenes stuff that got put out afterwards, there was pretty much no game at that point. They created the demo completely separately from what the actual game was. Mm-hmm. So the demo was like them at E3, the one from like a year before was them going, okay, this is our final intention for what the game should actually be. And so I look at Kickstarter sort of in the same way, is them going, okay, this is what we want to have happen. And, you know, Bungie is a competent enough development studio that they can make, for the most part, the stuff that they promised happen. It still wasn't complete in the way that I think a lot of people expected. And of course, that's why, you know, they'd had the ending that it did. But that proof of concept, they were actually able to turn into a game. But when you look at a lot of this stuff and a lot of these Kickstarters, that's not the case. A lot of these guys don't have the experience of someone like Bungie. And that's the other part of my trepidation is like, okay, it's great you think you can make this game do this, but you also don't have the capital in case you run into a problem.
Yeah. And usually you can spot the ones that might be problematic in that regard right away. But to that point, I would say, if you are skeptical to that degree, then I think you've kind of answered your own question.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I pretty much don't do it. I was just curious what you guys thought of it, simply because it's something that I don't really do.
Yeah. Well, my impressions of it in a broader scope, because that's really all I can speak to at this point, since I use Kickstarter sparingly, to say the least. but my overall impression when it's come to specifically projects that are relevant to my interests, they're, you know, that sort of cater toward my tastes in video games, has been really pretty positive.
Yeah. Well, I guess the other portion too for all intents and purposes that I should reveal is also that I can only imagine what my wife would do to me if she was like, so wait a minute, you just drop $100 on something that does not exist.
Yep.
And they'd be like, well, no, that's not how I'd look at it that way, but that's how my wife's going to look at it.
Yeah. See, I cannot speak to fighting that battle on any front. So
Teresa can, I'm sure.
You're on your own on that one.
Yeah. So that's the other thing. Yeah. That's the other, maybe that's what we should change it to, is that kickstarting works if you're not married with a child.
Yeah.
So there you go. Mm-hmm.
Cool. It's great for other people to contribute.
For other people. It's great for other people. That's the
Day Zero update. That should be the motto. Consumer demographic advice.
That should be the motto of Kickstarter. It's great for other people.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Pat, you want to take us into the Evo bikes?
Yeah. I didn't get to watch as much of it yesterday as I did on Friday, but there was a Street Fighter V panel on Friday, and we got a lot of pretty substantial information about it. The what you might call vanilla edition of the game is going to include 16 characters, 4 of whom will be newcomers, so it's basically the same as the arcade edition of vanilla Street Fighter IV.
Okay.
Any upgrades that they do, Super Street Fighter V, Street Fighter V Dash, whatever you want to call it, no disc releases. I'm not completely thrilled with that one because, relying on online updates, we saw how that worked out at Pro Tour. So, yeah, you know, as a tournament guy, that's sending off a few alarms for me. The really interesting part is that they say what they're describing sounds an awful lot like a free-to-play inspired model. Obviously, you're paying for the disc and, you know, the game, whether you download it or buy it in a store or whatever, but they're saying that any DLC that they introduce, new characters, whatever, will be attainable through, you know, more traditional unlocking methods, just as much, you know, you can pay to get to get the content right away, but you can also work for it.
That's actually a really interesting way of handling it.
Yeah,
I actually have no problem with it. Strictly speaking, it's going to depend on how they implement it, because like I'll just tell you guys this, like I don't know how much you guys actually get into PC games, but I think the model, they use the exact same model for Heroes of the Storm, and obviously I know they do the same kind of thing in League of Legends and Dota. So particularly like if they go the model of Heroes of the Storm, like say where they introduce new characters and they give you the ability to try them out and they have free weekends and stuff like that. That's actually works totally fine for me.
Well, this is what it is you can, through playing the game, you'll get something called fight money, so you can make the inside jokes now.
Yeah, no, that's the same way. That's the same way Heroes of the Storm works, is that you, when you win, you get gold, and then you can purchase the characters with gold.
Yep.
Or if you don't want to wait, if you're the kind of person that can't grind it out, then what you do is you just buy them with real money. And then like Blizzard puts characters and skins and all kinds of crap on sale every week.
Yeah, and Street Fighter V calls the real money currency Zenny. So
nice.
Old Capcom heads will probably catch that reference.
But I think that's cool. I think it's a good and it's a good way to keep people playing.
Yeah,
like that's the other part of this. When the core of your experience is people playing against one another, adding this kind of thing really isn't a bad, it's not a bad design choice, because it gets people into playing the game. Like for instance, in Hearthstone and in Heroes of the Storm, there are quests every single day. There are weekly quests in Heroes, in Heroes of the Storm. But in Hearthstone, there are daily quests that are like, win a set of matches with this type of character. And then in Heroes of the Storm, it's like, get to level 5 with this character, which that keeps the pool open for people to log in and to jump into the online portion of it, because they constantly have a carrot that they're working towards. Yeah. So for fighting games, I think as long as the amount you have to earn is not just some astronomical thing that then has you going, okay, you know, now I gotta buy this. I think as long as they don't do that, I think they'll be fine. And I think that's a great model to keep people invested in the game and to keep playing it. Because you know, we've seen it happen in so many games where the online just dries up because people have no continuing reason to play.
And you know, the save files on tournament consoles are going to have just absurd amounts of fight money just from regular use.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that just from the tournament standpoint for final round.
It's like, basically going to be free updates.
Yeah,
because they're going to have like whatever the gameplay quota is to make character downloads or upgrade kits. Well, balance updates, I think, are just going to be straight up free.
Yeah.
But you have to get the characters.
Yeah, because otherwise you'd have a group of people that would be like, well, I like the way the character plays in this patch, so I'm not updating.
Yeah, that would, you know, if you ended up with like a vanilla Sagat or something like that, you'd be fucked. Like systems for tournament stations are just going to have more than enough fight money at any given time.
Yeah.
Just through.
Well, now let me ask you this. Did they say specifically that the fight money is bound to the system? I'd assume it'd be bound to the account, right?
Well, yeah, the account is what I would assume.
But. Yeah. So I'm wondering from a tournament standpoint, if we would have I'm just thinking a lot at this point.
I think it'd be bound to the save file.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if we would just have, because that's the other thing. That's the other thing I'd wonder is that, if they let people sign in too, what if you go to a tournament? So while you're playing, you earn currency for yourself. Like that, most of these tournaments, people.
Would be fantastic.
Yeah, but see, the only problem with that is that you go to most of these tournaments, there's no Wi-Fi.
That's true.
So that would be interesting.
That's another reason I'm really skeptical about the online delivery model for all updates.
Well, that screwed us 1 year at Final Round because of Mortal Kombat. Like the updates that come over. They don't
stay. But there are a lot of them.
Yeah. So there was at one point, I think we had an issue. We had an issue with the system where it wasn't fully updated, and thankfully we caught it. But there was two
this year.
Yeah, and that stuff. You know, every tournament, this is an issue going forward, because it is like, okay, well, how do we make this work? How do we know we have the exact same thing? One or two
versions old.
Yeah.
And they went through pools and everything. It was bad.
Yeah. Well, if you know, if this game is actually being developed with, you know, tournament players in mind and, you know, tournament operators, I'd imagine, like, you know, Capcom will have some facility for them to just make sure that everything is kosher right off the get-go. Maybe like a USB stick plug in and they'll update themselves.
Yeah. The update, the update methods must be plentiful.
Yeah.
The only thing that I could say too, and Pat, of course, I know you understand this. The only thing that would that does have me a little bit apprehensive about this is that, and you know what? I think just to preface this before I even go on with my point, what the thing that drives a lot of innovation in fighting games, as far as the way that the players work, is basically coming up on something that they feel is almost insurmountable, and then finding a way around it. And like to a perfect example of that is Marvel 2. Marvel vs. Capcom 2 is completely broken out of the box. And for the longest time, everybody was scared to death of Doom because he could do a lockdown that you literally could not get out of. Same thing with Cable. When people figured out the Air Hyper Viper Beam, it was like there's just no way around this stuff. And they started finding, just with the way the game was programmed, that there were actual ways around that stuff. But it just took a while for the community to really be able to catch up to it. The only thing that really
in a very good place, though.
No, it didn't. But it does concern me going forward is that what if they find something that somebody feels is overpowered and then the fighting game community doesn't even actually get any time to play with it and really figure out if it is, or they just patch it out.
You're talking about Tanya.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She got just decimated.
And I think it was CEO that it's been said will forever be remembered as the Tanya tournament. And no more.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that concerns me. But hopefully Capcom has a more steady hand. Because that was the one cool thing about the stuff coming out on disc was that, yeah, if it's coming out on disc, then we know that this is what we're going to be playing with for a while. Yeah, so let's figure out how to work it. And that'll go away if they essentially – now, maybe it'll just be that they'll do the updates once a year and that'll be – or obviously, unless there's something, you know, terribly broken – in which case, they're sort of just turning it into Madden. And if they did that, I can't say I'd really be bothered by it. Because that's also one of those things where if we want these kinds of games to continue, there has to be more of a revenue stream than what there is now.
Yeah.
Especially since we lost arcades.
Yeah. You know, and I wouldn't be opposed to you know, a Street Fighter V Champion Edition a year down the road. Reuse the old names. I don't care at this point. Just do it. Well, they kind of already have been.
And I'm at the point too, as far as gaming goes, where I'm much more interested in really kind of like what's expected rather than and I'm willing to sort of pay into that. It's a big reason why I still like MMOs. At least I know what I'm getting. Yeah. And throwing that money to developers that want to provide that kind of product that I want, that doesn't bother me. So if, you know, if in order for fighting games to, you know, continue, because I was in the dark ages when I was helping run tournaments when we were doing Final Round and we didn't get any new games for 10 years. Like, I don't ever want to see something like that happen again. So that means that I got to throw an extra 40 at Capcom once a year, whatever.
Let it be said, though, we couldn't have asked for a better lineup of games for that period of time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And if those games weren't so good, nothing would have survived of the fighting game community. If they were just crap, then
we wouldn't have had... That was a special crop of games that I don't even know if we're ever going to see again.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, but like I said, to that point, if this means that in order to get the kind of games that I still want to play, then I got to give Capcom $40 a year, whatever.
Done.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll do it twice, you know. Imagine if I could do the same thing for Dragon Quest.
Well, you might not have to imagine too much longer. We'll have to wait and see on that one.
Yeah, I don't
know. And to finish the Street Fighter V news, Yoshinori Ono's been all over social media today saying that more information on the game will be coming tonight before Ultra Street Fighter IV Top 8. I can only imagine this is going to be character reveals, maybe even a release date. Because we're getting late enough in the year that I think they can start talking release date.
Yeah.
I'll just go. Well, and that would dovetail perfectly at Evo. Hey, guys, We have this completely captive audience. Check it out.
April 2016.
Yeah.
Get your hands on it.
Enjoy it. Do something. Treat yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would, I thought it was funny actually, at Comic-Con.
I would probably buy two copies if he just came out and said, treat yourself.
Yeah. Buy it for, well, actually, I probably will end up with two copies.
PC and PS4?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see doing that, especially if I end up with a gaming laptop, which I'm really leaning toward doing now at some point.
Don't. We'll talk about that offline.
Pat, okay, treat yourself.
No. Well, no, I just want a portable fighting game rig where I can play Street Fighter 4, Street Fighter 5, Mortal Kombat, things like that, wherever I happen to be.
Yeah.
Where are you going to put it that it's not going to get stolen?
Well, I always keep my things where they're not going to get stolen.
That would mean you would be shoving the gaming laptop in your pants. Which that might actually be funny. Oh, look at that. That guy at the tournament's got a fighting game laptop in his crotch.
Again with the pants. This is 2 weeks in a row. We're ending on pants.
Oh, you know what? There was something. What was I going to say? There's something I wanted to end on. And now I can't remember because we started.
There was some other Evo stuff, too. I mean, did you even. Did anyone else here catch Street Fighter 4 pools?
Nope.
No, I didn't.
Tekken 7? Tekken 7 looks fantastic.
I have not had a chance. Well, I played Tekken 7.
I did see Gustavo just destroy that kid. That was that was not pretty.
Well, no, I've been in a similar situation, and let me tell you, there it's awkward no matter what. No matter what you do, you're going to be the bad guy.
Yeah.
But
I do that to my kid. Like, I do not let him win. Like, you were going to earn it. Like, that's a life lesson. Like, not trying to be a dick. Like, I ease into it with him. It's not like I could just go full bore on him every single time. But it's like, you have to, like, kind of raise up to that. But if you're also going to the biggest fighting game tournament in the world, you can't expect people to have any semblance of mercy. Because that's the other thing. People don't forget. At Evo, what was it, like 2 years ago? Or maybe, God, it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago. I was there. I haven't been to Evo in a while. But they had that, like, that 9-year-old who beasted on people. Yeah. Like, it was crazy. Like, he was whooping people's asses. Like, if I was an adult, I would be embarrassed. Like, all right, I'm just going to go ahead and commit seppuku right now because this is just, like, on stream in front of everybody at Vegas. Like, I got my ass whooped by a 9-year-old. Like,
I have dishonored my family and my ancestors.
Yeah, my dojo has officially disowned me.
Yeah.
I can't go back to the Get Some Dojo in Atlanta because, you know, I got whooped on. But yeah, you can't go to a fighting game tournament like Evo and then be like, well, I'll coast on. Like, that kid got a lesson.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that kid got a lesson, but he could have easily been another one of those, you know, prodigies. Yeah. You can't and tell.
You could actually pinpoint the moment that Gustavo stopped taking him seriously. It wasn't even subtle. He just, all right, we're done here.
So.
But I've been in this situation before. It was at, I won't say that exact situation because A, it wasn't on stream, and B, there were other things contributing to it. It was at Vanilla Street Fighter 4 National Qualifiers, which will forever be known as that shitty GameStop tournament. And one of my early matchups in the tournament in round one was this kid must have been 12 years old or so. And I'm not going all out. I probably should have. I'm just doing some pretty fundamental stuff with spacing. And I mean, it was the week the game came out, so a lot of us really didn't get Street Fighter 4, but we got Street Fighter. And so I'm just doing some really basic stuff, just playing it safe to what I know. I hear this kid's brother behind me going, "It's okay, you can still win this one. He's not that good." Now, I was conflicted. I'd been over the rules. I couldn't take a swing at the guy because that would be a disqualification. I couldn't open my mouth and say something in response because whatever it would have been NC-17, and that would have been a disqualification.
No. Really?
So over the course of about 20 seconds I'm mulling this over, and I realize I have no other recourse but to nail this kid to a cross. And so I do my best Daigo impression, which may not be a great one, but it was certainly an effective one. Lots of shameless baiting, lots of just kind of more the stylish side of combos. And of course, I was taunting every time I knocked him down.
But Pat, it was the kid's brother, not the kid.
It was during the match. I didn't have a whole lot of time to mull it over, and I had to keep my mouth shut.
Shame. It's the principle of the thing, man.
Yeah, dude. Like, here's the other thing, though. Think about it. Like, because here's the thing. The reason I'm even saying this is because when I was growing up, I was really good in the arcade when I was a kid. My mom saw me whoop up on people, and that's why she was convinced, like, holy crap, like, I should actually give him some quarters because he knows what he's doing. And, like, so we'd go to the arcade, I'd mollywop somebody, and then we'd go home. But the thing with that is, though, is that I also encountered many people that were so far ahead of what I was doing that it wasn't even funny. And, of course, they were, because I was like, what, 10 when Street Fighter II came out? And
we're about the same age, I think.
Yeah.
I think I was 9 or 10 when World Warrior came out.
Yeah. So like, here I am. I'm that kid that's like, all right, well, I'm gonna have to throw this guy a whooping, like, you know. But the thing with that is, when you have that, you have to have that mindset too, though. Like, if you're gonna throw a whooping towards a kid, they might not come back. Yep. Like, that's what, because I remember the people that I know, there were people that I played that went easy on me. Like, there was no way they couldn't have gone easy on me, because, like, I mean, hell, the guy that got me into Street Fighter III when I was like 20. Went easy on me. Like, if he had just gone like full force, I never would have kept playing that game.
Yeah, I should have told his brother to get on along those same lines.
Yeah, I didn't have time to formulate anything more complicated than all out.
You know? Well, if it's a whooping, you're a one.
Yeah, his brother didn't say anything else, so I got what I wanted.
Fair enough.
But yeah, it's one of those situations you'll run into in tournaments, and, you know, no matter what you do, if you're coming out on top, you're going to be the bad guy. And so it was just kind of funny watching that. I mean, Polygon wrote something about it, and it's like, hey, that kind of reminds me of something.
I actually have kind of a similar story, but actually this went the other way.
Oh?
Yeah, well... Here in the...
Where you tried to do the full court press to a kid and got your ass whooped?
No, actually, it was a little different than that. I was, I think, I was probably about 14 at the time, maybe. And we have a little video store here on the corner, and they had a Street Fighter II, they had a hyper fighting machine. And there was this dude there who was beasting on absolutely everybody. So I take him on, and as... was going to happen, I got my ass handed to me.
Mm-hmm.
But this dude was super cool. He was like, okay. He sees, like, okay, you got, like, the basics down. Come here tomorrow after school. I'll show you what's up. And that one ass kicking improved my game immensely. Because he then, you know, took me under his wing, quite literally, and got... And I learned a lot more about Street Fighter II than I ever had. I learned Negative Edge from him. I learned pretty much everything.
Wow. So really what Phil is saying, Pat, is that now that kid's going to turn into a crack dealer because you were an asshole. How do you feel?
Well, this was 6 years ago. It might have happened by now.
So, you know, it can go both ways.
Yeah. And... Yeah,
beating up on kids.
Okay.
It was remember a tournament.
Though, he lives in Utah, so this was probably, he probably went over to Wyoming at this point.
Kids are probably asking for it.
Memories.
I was going to say, there is one thing I did want to ask you guys about, and I don't know if you discussed it on some of the shows where I wasn't here. So I read on Kotaku about Fire Emblem. And the new one.
Yep.
and how like the, what the crux of the game is and like the choice that you make in the beginning. And I have not
the choice that you make at the sales counter.
No, no. Well, yeah, at the sales counter. But like the idea of that choice, I cannot say that I have been this excited to see both sides of something in a video game in a tremendously long time.
Oh yes.
Because it's not a complicated, it's a very complicated decision. It's
and there's also a third option that's the DLC.
Yeah. I was just fascinated by the whole idea. I don't want to spoil it for anybody that wants to kind of know what the decision is, but
I don't really think it's a spoiler considering the entire game's business model is planned around it.
Oh, maybe, but I found the whole idea of it, especially now that, you know, I have a family, utterly fascinating. So and again, I'm probably behind the, you know, behind the times on that one, but that I will definitely get it. Oh God, I don't want to.
I need that game.
Versions. I'm going to get both damn versions and people around my house will play it. Yeah. So,
I hear you. Absolutely. I am all about that game.
And I'll tell you, I think it's interesting too, because I think, at least for me, you know, now of course the choice is what's interesting to me. Now the story that follows may not be. But I think that that's one of those things where just based on that choice, I can't say that I particularly feel bad about the way that they've monetized it. That doesn't really bother me. Oh. I think it's kind of shitty, yes, but I look at it in the same way that I look at the Pokemon stuff where, you know, there are two versions of the game because there's separate stuff in each. So, you know. I don't know. I just wanted to just bring that up as like, you know, kind of an addendum to the show. I was just fascinated by the whole idea of it because that is a top quality plot pivot, essentially, that I would not have expected from Nintendo.
At the same time, wouldn't that kind of be like releasing a Jedi version and a Sith version of Knights of the Old Republic?
Yeah. Mm. But I think now here's where I may be off. I may be off, and I don't realize it. Is that my understanding was that based on you know kind of the version that you pick and which route you go, everything is going to be different. Like the core gameplay is going to be the same, but the story and everything is going to be different. So I would say, like at least like if you're talking about like that, like you know the Jedi version or like a Sith version of Knights of the Old Republic, the thing is even with that decision, the game still ends up the same way. It sounds like, at least with this, that it could go completely differently.
Yeah.
So that was all I wanted to say. That's one of those games where I'm like, oh my God. Yeah. Like, I'm totally.
I need that.
This now. Like, yeah, go. All right, fine. Shut up and take my money. Like, and very few games just on the plot alone have me like, that is really intriguing.
Mm-hmm. So, well, then you go beyond the plot, it is goddamn Fire Emblem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course that means they'll probably release amiibos for it that I can't buy. But
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah, but yeah. Anyway, that was all I wanted to say. I just think that's fascinating, and I would love to see more games. Maybe not in that monetary model, but I would love to see more games have that kind of choice where it just completely unfolds differently in the console space. You know, we've seen similar stuff. In PC games, but I cannot think of something that drastic on the consoles, let alone a handheld console.
Yeah.
So,
because you know,
if that was a Sony game or a Microsoft game, that would have been on the home consoles, not on a portable.
Yeah.
Because the closest I can think of that is, you know, Witcher 2, where one decision you make will determine there's like a whole third of the game that you won't see, depending on.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually honestly the closest one that I could think of. Yeah, because if you make that one decision and you go with the chick, you end up with certainly a more personal story. Whereas if you make the decision to stay with the, I think it was the military or whatever, you get kind of like this more like sweeping epic game where Geralt might as well just be, you know, a generic badass. That's probably, I think, the closest analog I can think of to it. Where that decision completely alters fundamentally how the game works from there on out, at least from the plot. So,
yeah.
So we'll talk about abortion next week.
Yeah.
So with that, I think we'll call it a show for this week. As usual, I'm Filippo D'Analfo.
I'm Patrick Meslin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
I'm Lee Lamb.
And I'm Teresa Sammons.
And we'll see you all next week.